the laws that pertain to a ben Noach, the seven Noachide laws, the question is being raised that in general they make sense, an ordinary common sense level, that these all are essential to establishing a life, a civilized life, of course, based upon the foundation of God. That's extremely important. And the obliteration of idolatry. So you didn't ask the question about idolatry. Hmm? You didn't ask the question about idolatry.
Well, I did, because I thought that fit in.
We're going to review the seven Noahide laws. The point being that, in general, they make sense to us on a simple level. We don't have to delve too deeply to see that it's establishing the foundations of a philosophically useful way of life. So the Rambam says in the ninth chapter of Hilchas Malachim, Al Shisha Dvarim Nitztave Adam Harishon. Adam Harishon was commanded on six things. So he had six of the seven. He didn't have all seven. Al Avodah Zarah, concerning idolatry. Idolatry is crucial because you can't talk about a civilized order for human beings if it's rooted in idolatry, if it's not based upon the true idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, of the fundamentals of reality, of existence. The person is steeped in idolatry, he's really lacking in terms of his in terms of his basic functioning as a human being. That's part of the essential makeup of a person, is a need within the individual to have a recognition of the ultimate scheme of things, essentially as to why he exists, what is the character of his existence. And if a person is completely distorted on that issue and he can't recognize that the universe in which he finds himself, the world in which he finds himself, is not a self-sustaining phenomenon, but that he's the product of a supreme being, and even worse, that he actually begins to deify. That is, you see, the element within him which is looking for something supreme. Everybody is a believer on some level. It's in the nature of man to deify. So there's no such thing as an absolute atheist in the true philosophical sense, because even people that deny the true God, they find a substitute. Something or other becomes their God. God that is to say that they worship, but that's the ultimate. Because really, if a person doesn't believe in God, the truth of the matter is they should really stop existing. Or just live an animalistic kind of existence. Because if there's no God, so then basically you're saying that your whole existence is an accident. So what is the point? All these people, they have a framework of values and things that, ideals, and that they're important, and they're living for, and they're striving for, and they're trying to perpetuate. But what's the point? The whole thing is just an accident. So how can you say that something or other has significance? How could it be significant that it came into being as a result of an accident? If you're telling me that the very foundation of reality is all accidental and meaningless, purposeless, absolutely meaningless, there's no reason, no rhyme. That's what you're saying. If you're saying it's all an accident, so now after the fact, how can something begin to be important and have meaning and significance when the whole picture is an accidental phenomenon? Do you swallow? Do you absorb that? It's manufacturing it. It doesn't exist. That's all true. All this talk about meaning in life and a purpose and a direction and all of that is true if you started with the basic premise that life itself has some reason, some rhyme and reason, some goal, some purpose. If you assume that this is why the world exists, and this is what it was created for, and this is the objective, so then in our own framework we try to adjust ourselves towards that objective. But if, after all said and done, this whole universe is just an accident, didn't have to come into being at all, aside from the question is that if that's the case, then it can just go out of existence just as accidentally, that everything's just an accident. So what's the point? What are you striving after? It's an accident. So you just realize that you happen to be an unintended consequence of a certain accident. So then what are you going to do? It's going to last for a while. Either you could remove yourself, because you don't want to be here. There's no reason why you should be here. You're just all an accident. You face the consequences of that. And, or else you don't want to kill yourself, so then just plan to do something. Why do people have all these plans about the future and humanity and mankind? It's meaningless. There's no basis for it at all. It's not true. Ultimately, it's not true because the whole thing is an accident. People don't realize the consequences of not believing in God. The person doesn't believe in the Creator. There's no basis for all of the humanitarian concepts and ideals. I just pointed out recently in a class that if you don't believe in God, there's no idea of human rights. I was explaining the concept of Yahavta L'Recha Kamocha, you should love your friend as yourself. That's only conceivable if a person believes in the foundations, the existence of God, and the world exists because of the will of God. In that framework, then each individual is endowed by the Creator with rights and so forth. If you deny the Creator, then you deny any type of morality whatsoever. Let's think about that for a minute. If there's no Creator and you follow that train of thought, so then you're just an accident and I'm just an accident. Just happens to come into existence through some indifferent processes which nobody can understand. Now, that proposition itself is kind of irrational as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't make any sense. You're basically saying that something comes into existence from nothing. So it doesn't appeal to my mind, the whole idea. But I'm going to follow through on the consequences, the logic of those who want to maintain that way. That there's all you find yourself in existence as a result of an accident. And then I look around and I see other existences whose life has no meaning whatsoever. You're telling me that I should respect, that I have to respect you, that you have a right. Where do you get a right from? You're just an accident. So what right do you have? On what basis do you have any rights? Why shouldn't I kill you if you get in my way? Why shouldn't I gag every... I'm just a existing... I'm like an animal. I'm just a being that exists for one thing. Satisfaction of what I want. That would be the only logical conclusion. For a person to do anything, to engage in any activity which is outside of the realm of the satisfaction of his immediate desires, would be absolutely absurd. Even to work for mankind would be absurd, unless you could get something out of it. Selfishness would be the only principle. Now, if, I know people will say, well, if that's the case, you're gonna, if you kill the other guy, he'll kill you. That's a practical utilitarian type of an approach, which is not what we're talking about. Because in that framework, yeah, you're right. I wouldn't kill you if I was concerned that your friends would kill me. I would only confine myself to killing people that I feel confident wouldn't get better, like the sniper. According to that framework, what's wrong with the sniper? Whatever the benefit or reason he's getting, why is he a horrible person? Perhaps that's his philosophy. You can't condemn the person until you know his philosophy. If that's his philosophy, so then there's nothing wrong with him. He's not immoral. It shows you how shallow people are. The thinking of people about significant issues is very, very shallow. That's my proposition. Yeah. There's no morality. There's no basis of morality, humanitarianism, all of these concepts. If they deny the Creator, then they're absolutely without any validity whatsoever. There's no concept of human rights if it's outside of the framework of a supreme being who established a system, and he's the one who determines what shall be and what shall not be, what's right and what's wrong. Then you have an idea of right and wrong. There's no right and wrong if there's no system. If life is an accident, then anything goes. But then what difference does it make anyway? The whole thing's an accident. Who cares? Who cares if you're destroying this or you're destroying that? The whole thing is just an accident anyways. And it may self-destruct in 2 minutes. Why would a person have any confidence at all that anything is going to continue? Because just like it came into being as a complete accident, it may go out of existence as a complete accident. This whole thing is a worthless endeavor. Think through the consequences. I don't want to depress anybody, because I assume you don't have that premise. but you better get God quickly or else you're going to get very depressed. Well, you make gospel to have any system of right and wrong.
Right.
That's going to be objective, because then you're going to have to go towards utilitarian, whatever is useful. Whatever is useful means that there's nothing inherently good or bad about this. It's just a question of consequences. So then it's up to the person. Each person decides for himself what his considerations are and what the consequences are for him. So if the person decides that in his system it's better for him to be a robber, and that gives him the greatest satisfaction, there's no way that you can say that it's wrong. Because you can't say that there's any virtue in hard work or anything else. Because you can't talk about an ideal. There's no basis. There's no objective. It's an accident. All you could say is that working hard and being thrifty and all that is good. It works for you. It's a good way to live. That's all you could say. To which the other person who steals the money will say that it is a good way. It's a good way for you. Good way for me to wait around and steal what you earn. That's the way it goes in the animal kingdom. Take a look. There are some animals that wait until other animals make a capture, they wait around and they chase them away and they run off with the kill. Right? Right and wrong to the animal kingdom. No intelligent person. Because it's all governed by pure instinct. And that makes sense. Now, if we assume God, and then man is different, then he's endowed with the soul, so then you can't make the leap from the animal kingdom to man. You have to judge man in a different realm. But if you don't make that, if you don't believe in that, and you don't believe in God, you don't believe in man being a higher form of existence, so then it's just an instinctual phenomenon. So man should follow his instincts. Now, of course, his intelligence will tell him that in certain cases it's not good to follow his instinct. That's something else. That's a different type of control of the instinct. It's essentially controlling the instinct in order to gain more instinctual gratification. So therefore, a person will control his anger and will not attack another person who is stronger than he is. Just because he's angry at him, he won't do it. He'll control his instinct. But that's instinctual. Animals are the same way. But what other principle should a person adopt except that principle? That he's just here for a short while because of an accident, and there's nothing that he can achieve. There's no achievement. It's all in the mind. It's all illusory. And the only thing is, all these other things are nonsensical. To try and get a name for himself and be remembered and be in history, whatever, that's all absurd. It's all imaginary. It's not real. Has no value whatsoever. So, there is no value, there's just your existence, that's all there is. That's it, just your existence. And anything that gives you pleasure is good, and anything that gives you pain is bad. That's how you'd look at it. And I would agree with that, if that were the foundation of reality. It's amazing how people don't think through the consequences of being an atheist. And so we're continuing with the idea of the Shem Mitzvah B'nei Noach. And yesterday we discussed the idea of Avodah Zarah and why the entire foundation of any type of a civilized existence, a human existence, as we know, it is possible only on the foundation of the Creator. So he's commanded with regard to the prohibition of Avodah Zarah. The Al Birkas Hashem. Birkas Hashem is a euphemism. It really means the opposite. It would be, so to speak, a curse to utter what would be considered to be a curse of Hashem. Now, that's a very complex area in terms of what exactly would the person say which would constitute a curse, so to speak. Blasphemy is the way it's described. That's the term that's utilized. That's a very serious avera, and it carries the death penalty. You have to curse a fellow Jew. And what's considered a curse is when you utilize the Shem Hashem. That is, for example, to say God damn you to a certain individual. To say those words would constitute a curse, according to the Torah. Because you're utilizing the name of God for the sake of, so to speak, cursing somebody else. Part of the prohibition of cursing. It's something that everybody senses is wrong. To elucidate it philosophically is not so simple. It requires thought and study to get to the root of what the evil is about. It's a serious evil. But over here, we're not talking about that. We're talking about something which is even more preposterous, sounds very, very preposterous, that a person would seek to utilize the mechanism of a curse against the Creator himself. And it has to actually, because there's a lot of technicalities in terms of halakha, it has to be done with the Shem Hashem. Being in both senses, as being the subject and the object, so to speak. That is, in the sense that Yaka Yosi is Yosi, is the way the Gemara. That God, so to speak, should be the one who, because the idea in reality, you can't curse God. If a person has a true idea, the whole thing is absurd. But anyway, there's a lot of complexities over there. So that's something which is more serious, but it, in a sense, it's more difficult to understand what kind of a person is uttering it, what's motivating it, what type of a distortion, what kind of corruption is this, because either a person recognizes God or doesn't recognize God. That seems to be the way it breaks down. So those who don't recognize God deny it. They don't curse God. They don't believe in God. If you don't believe in God, you don't believe in God. There's no point in cursing. On the other hand, those who believe in God, so we respect God. God is the Creator. God is the Supreme Being. So this kind of a notion is very, very complicated. It appears to be some type of a distortion of the psyche. And it carries a death penalty. That's the case that's actually recorded in the Torah. I'm going to take that up with regard to that being one of the seven Noahide laws. In general, it's acceptable because we recognize that it's very serious. It's a very serious violation. So even if you don't understand it specifically and the mechanisms behind it, it's not challenging to us in the sense that why should this be one of the seven Noahide laws? That question arises if you're talking about something which we recognize is wrong, but we don't regard that, we don't see at first sight why that should be so significant. That's the question that's been raised with regard to the prohibition of Eivam min ha-chai, a limb from a living animal. That's something where the question has been raised. Why, of all the different prohibitions in the Torah, why is that so significant that it warrants a place among the seven? Next one is Shfichus Damim, murder. That we understand. That's Motirzach. Thou shalt not murder. That's one of the Aseret HaDibros, the Ten Commandments. So the foundation of any type of a civilized system of life obviously has to be the prohibition against murder. So that makes sense to us. The Algili Arroyos and forbidden sexual relations. That also makes sense to us. That's also in the Aseret HaDibros. Lotinah, that adultery, so to speak, but other cases of forbidden sexual relations. In order to establish a society that's productive, that's creative, it means to say that a person has to gain control over the sexual, has to establish boundaries. Societies which give in to the emotions, to the instincts, are completely consumed by the sexual, eventually they dissipate. It's a major, major problem. You see it happening in our society today in terms of the breakdown of the sexual controls, the so-called sexual revolution, which has been going on for about 30 years now, and all these different movements that come to the fore in terms of gays, gay rights, and along with this you have abortion rights and so forth. This is a dangerous phenomenon for society. And by the way, this is relevant to the Dora Mabel. The two major sins of the Dora Mabel were the sexual area, the failure to impose controls, the loss of controls in the sexual, and then it spilled over into the relations between people in terms of the inability to respect the rights of others, the violent factor. That we understand. Then it mentions Viola Gezel, theft. That's obviously a fundamental. People can't engage in any kind of productive activity if there's theft. You have to have protection. Yeah, obviously, no one's going to bother working. And that's going to lead to murder, and it's going to lead to a destruction. So you can't have any kind of productivity in society. All these things are extremely serious. It's that we fail to take note of it. There's a lot of theft in our society today. Maybe in a more sophisticated fashion, corporate theft and all these scandals in the stock market, insider trading, and things of that sort. Gezel. V'yahadinim. And dinim would be that they have to set up a judicial system, a court system, to enforce the oath. Okay? It says, Hosef Lenoach, Eber Menachai. That these were the six. They remained in existence until Noach, after the flood. And God added for Noach, and of course all subsequent generations, Eber Menachai. The limb of a living animal. Shenemar, Ach Basar Benafsho, Domo, Benafsho Domo, Lo Sochelo. That's a reference to the fact that as long as the animal is alive, you're not allowed to eat it, which means to say that it seems to be basic, humane method of dealing with animals. That before you're permitted, permission was granted to eat meat, but the animal has to be killed properly first. As far as Jews are concerned with Shechita, as far as Goyim are concerned, they don't require Shechita. That's only for Jews. But nevertheless, the animal must be killed. Must be killed humanely. The Rambam is not talking about that now, but that's included. But the point at which it would become a violation would be that the person partook of the animal before it was dead. I mean, basically that the animal cannot be eaten from until it's dead. So, for example, if the animal was slaughtered, shechita, kosher slaughter, that in certain cases, there'll be a difference between how the law works for a ben Noach, for a Noachite, and for a Jew. Basically, once the animal has been slaughtered properly, and even if it's still shaking, then at that point, it's no longer considered to be Eiver Menachai. For a guy, the animal has to be dead. Alright, but the question that we're interested in is, why does this assume such significance? But what you really have to do is to undertake a bit of an investigation of the significance of Eiver Menachai. Okay, I guess the first part, I don't know, my heart test, voracious. After the marble, so God addresses Noah. Certain changes are instituted. For example, the phenomenon of the fear that animals are now given a fear of man. Then it says in that same pasuk, "V'chol ha'shetirmos v'adamah v'chol d'gei hayam b'yetchem nitanum," that everything, all the various creatures, are given over to your hand, something which didn't exist before. Kol remes ha'she'ochai lachem yeliachla. Every animal, so to speak, that's alive, I'm giving you to eat. Well, no restrictions have been placed on Noah in terms of which animals he can eat. The idea of prohibited species, that's part of the Torah, that's for the Jews. Kiyarek Esav, Nasati Lachem Eskol. That it's just like the grasses, or the vegetables, so to speak, which there's no restriction, a person can have whatever he wants. So too, I've given you all the animals. Ach, basar benafsho damo, basar benafsho damo lo sochelo. That the flesh, where the blood is still in it, the blood meaning the life, meaning that it's still alive. So flesh of an animal that's still alive, you may not eat. That's a limitation. Ach. Now, in that case, then it mentions v'achas dimchem l'nafsho seichem. Now it goes on to Adam. And your own blood of your soul, that means your own life. Edrosh miyat kolchaya. Edrosh miyat kolchaya edrishenu. I will demand, so to speak. Demand means I'll hold it accountable in terms of avenging. There's an accountability for the killing of people. Miyad kol chaya ed rishenu. According to Rashi, it means that if an animal kills a person, so God will hold the animal responsible, so to speak, even though there's no true responsibility by an animal. But that animal will be punished. Umiyad adam, and from the hands of man, miyad ish achiv ed rosh es nefesh adam. Yeah. Say, basic idea is that whoever kills, that any person that kills, God will demand his punishment, his life. And then it's reiterated, shofech dam ha'adam, one who spills the blood of man, ba'adam damo yishavech, that his blood shall be spilled by Adam. Ki betzelem elokim asos Adam. Because God created man in the tzelem elokim, in the image of God. There's many ideas that are implied over here. Rashi connects the two ideas. Take a look at Rashi and hey, v'achas dimchem, but your blood, afalpi shehetarti lachem kilas neshama babahema, even though I permitted the taking of the so-called soul, it's not the same soul, you need to destroy the life force of the animal, as dimchem edrosh, I will demand the blood, mea shofech dam atzmo, from someone who spills his own blood. That's a reference to suicide. So Rashi learns that the immediate subject that comes after it is the subject of killing Adam. It starts off with suicide. Then it goes on to killing other people. Let's take a look. Let's learn with Rashi. Dimchem lenafsho seichem. So Rashi says, afachonek atzmo. Afalpi shelo yotzu mimenu dam. Even one who chokes himself. Even if no blood went forth. That's very difficult for me to understand. What's the difficulty? Problem with this is, why do I need a specific reference to choking oneself? Once we've learned that suicide is prohibited, what difference does it make? How it's done, whether there's actual physical blood. When we use the term spilling blood, we don't mean necessarily that the actual blood came forth, that you killed someone. So most of the time that means spilling the blood, but there could be other ways. You could poison someone. You could choke someone. So I don't think once you told me that I'm not permitted, that no one's permitted to commit suicide, I would no longer have any doubt. Oh, so you can't slash your wrist. And then someone, well, what about choking yourself? So what's the difference? I'd say, what's the difference? What difference does it make the manner? Or taking an overdose? Rashi creates a difficulty for us because Rashi said that the pasuk had to come and tell you, even after it told you that you can't commit suicide, it had to tell you that you can't choke yourself because you might have thought that it's only when blood is spilled. That's very difficult for me to understand. Why would I have thought that? You follow? Rashi on Miyad Kol Chaya. Because Rashi learns that that's what it's saying, that God will demand the blood, even if an animal kills a person. Obviously the problem with that is that it's different. If an animal kills someone, you can't say that the animal committed a sin.
Yeah.
The animal just operates according to its instincts. So what's the purpose? What's the point of God taking revenge? Now, in a human society, if an animal should kill, like a dog, a wild dog should kill a person, then the people should, the society should execute the animal. Of course, it's because it's dangerous, but even aside from that, it's making a point. It's establishing a point.
Yeah.
The value of human life. That's extremely important. So therefore people in general would be much more careful if they have pets that are aggressive, whatever. In terms of doing something which expresses our regard for human life, so then you would kill an animal that killed a person. That would make sense. But here it's saying that God will do so. That is to say, it implies that even if it's not in the context of a society, it's in the woods, it's in the wilderness, and any animal that should kill, a lion or whatever it is, a man-eater, so God will take the revenge. That's hard for us to understand, because what's the point? What purpose does that serve? Okay? Rashi and Miyad Kol Chaya. Rashi says, L'fi shechatu dor hamavol, because the generation of the flood sin. V'hufkaru l'machal chayos roz lishlot v'hen. And then they became hefker, so to speak, to be eaten by wild beasts to rule over them. Shenemar, he says, nimshal kabehemos nidmu. They're akin to the animals. They became like animals. Leficha chutzrich lahazir aleim es achayos. Therefore, it was necessary to warn, so to speak, the chayos, the animals. Interesting. Kabehemos nidmu, the way the Medrash is learning, nimshal is from Moshe'el. So nimshal would mean, according to the Medrash, he has become ruled. He has become dominated, so to speak, by the animals, kavehemos nidmo, because they became similar to animals. That is to say that this is the idea of the Midrash, that when his status went down, in the generation of the Mabel, they lost all sense of control, which is based upon the Tzelem Elokim, and they began to live like animals. So therefore, because they became like animals, they then became prey to the animals. Whatever the case is, a barrier was broken down. And then they were subject to being killed by the animals. That's the sense that Rashi means. Yeah, therefore, l'ficha chutzrach, because of this situation that developed in the time of the Mabel, the Torah needed to warn, so to speak, to establish a warning to the animals not to kill man. Of course, that's very, very difficult, because what kind of a warning? It doesn't make sense in the ordinary way of understanding things. A warning is only to those who hear the warning. Animals don't have intelligence on that level. So by God proclaiming in the Torah that God would hold every animal accountable, it's not a warning. It can't be understood that way. Placing some kind of a limitation on the animals is in the pasuk itself. In pasuk Beis, it says, "Umorachem v'chitchem yeh," that God is placing the fear of man in the al kol chay haaretz, on all the beasts of the field of the land. The al kol of shemayim. That is to say that this is a change. Okay, this is the Torah telling us where that comes from. That it wasn't that way all the time, but this was brought about by a special intervention, so to speak, of God after the flood. Before the flood, it didn't exist. That fits in with the idea of Chazal that the nature of Adam was tremendously changed. I explained last week that before the flood, Adam was the most powerful creature in existence. So he was stronger than any other animal, so there was no need for a special fear. But as a result of the weakened state after the Mabel, Adam was in a weakened state. So then there was a danger that he would be killed by the animals. That danger is much greater in ancient times than today. Today we have the weapons and so forth to protect ourselves much, much better. But in those days, it would have been a serious problem if the animals would have attacked man. They would have come out of their forests and whatever and attacked man. Man lived more in the open. So therefore, God is redressing that by changing the nature of animals so that even though they're more powerful than man, but they have a natural fear. What are you looking at me like? I said, yeah. Got to the discussion about Avram and Achai and why that's one of the seven Noahide laws. It's being suggested that there's a certain element of aggression associated with the eating of meat. That does seem to be borne out by the context of the Psukim, because it states when God gave Noah permission to eat meat, so then that was modified. Basar benafsho, benafsho damo lo socheilu, that you can't eat the meat until you actually kill it. And then it goes into the prohibitions against the killing people. which does suggest that that this does cater to man's aggressive instincts. Okay, considering different possibilities. Another suggestion along these lines is that, for example, in Kashrut, that we have an elaborate system of restraints on what we're permitted to eat and under what circumstances we're permitted to eat them, which gives us the ability to gain control over our instincts and not to be consumed by our instincts for the purpose of living a intelligent existence, and that these laws don't apply to Gentiles, so that perhaps the law of not eating the animal until it's killed is a minimal element of control, that the Gentile too has to exercise a certain restraint over his desire to eat. It's possible to say that. There's no question that, in fact, it's true. But that the question remains, is that the ultimate objective or just a byproduct? You understand what I'm saying? Is that the ultimate objective? Searching for is the main reason. Now, the main reason, for example, the purpose of having a red light and stopping at a red light is to avoid accidents. It has a secondary benefit, of course, is that a person now has to be attuned and he has to exercise a certain restraint and he has to plan ahead and all those other factors. But that's not the reason why the law was instituted. Once the law is instituted, it can have many other benefits. So the question over here is that just because you can point out a benefit in having to restrain yourself and having to see to it that the animal is killed properly, and therefore it's exercising control over the instinctual, the question still remains, is that the main purpose that it was established for, or it's just a byproduct? Okay? You say that that's the reason, is because Hinochais are restricted to 7 mitzvahs. And these all represent things of major, major importance. Yeah. They kind of define the fundamentals of what a civilized life would be, based upon the recognition of HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the foundations, not to kill, not to steal, of an organized civil structure. So therefore, that would seem to be a benefit. The fact that a person has a greater control over his appetites or lesser control, a system which is designed to maintain greater control, I'm not sure that would qualify as being one of the 7. Keep searching. If I can't find any other explanations, so that'll have to do for the time being. But let's see if we can go beyond that. Laws pertaining to a Noachide are more lenient. We have 613 mitzvahs. They have 7 mitzvahs, categories, whatever you want to say. With regard to the realm of the sexual, controlling the sexual, they do have a measure of control. But you see, with them, it has to do with the fact where the sexual threatens to break down the foundations of a society that is adultery. People were permitted to just take whatever they please, somebody else's wife, so that would be the destruction of any kind of a civilized way of life. People would be at war with each other. You couldn't have normal, stable marriages, which is the root of a family. The family structure is the root of a healthy society, that's for sure. So therefore, one can argue that it's a byproduct. It's true that he's restricted in terms of his sexual desires, but the main purpose is not so much that, but the effects, the consequences of not having any protection. When a person marries a woman, it presupposes a certain permanence, a certain protection that has to be respected. That's why it's prohibited. See, that guy was not given an elaborate system which is designed to control the sexual instinct to such a fine degree as you find in the Torah for Jews. He's much more unrestricted when it comes to the types of women that he could have. It's a possibility. And it's based upon the Ramban's explanation of Kan Sipor. When a person comes upon a bird sitting on its chicks, so it's an interesting kind of a law. The Ramban goes on at length in explaining it. that you're not allowed, Lotikacha Aim ala Banim. You're not allowed to take the mother together with the children, that is. You can't take the children with the mother there. But first you must send away the mother. Separate them, then you can take the chicks. So there's a whole argument between the Ramban and the Rambam as to the reason. We're not going to go through the entire discussion now. But the basic conclusion of the Ramban is that this is intended for our benefit, for our perfection. And the perfection that it provides is it develops, it nurtures, it cultivates within us a certain sense of rachamim, of mercy. Because the whole discussion as to whether it's because God is mercy, God's mercies to the animal or not. The Ramban concludes that it's essentially for our purpose. That we, as a result of this, will cultivate a sense of compassion for all living beings, for the animals, and of course for people as well. And it's interesting, the Pasuk says that the reward, this is similar to the case of honoring your father and mother, l'man yarichun yamecha, in order that you'll have length of days. So it would seem that this element, this attribute of compassion, is extremely significant in enabling a human being to achieve the real purpose of their existence. Even though, as we learn, you can't just follow an emotion, any emotion. You can't just follow the emotion in terms of its natural course. Even the emotion of compassion, if allowed to separate itself from chachma, from wisdom, and to just follow its course wherever it leads you, can bring about the greatest harm, as we've seen. That's why it's always Torah's chesed. It has to be the Torah of chesed. Then we learned this morning, in terms of the mesis, one who seduces another Jew into idolatry, so to be merciful to him is to be cruel. It's a form of cruelty. So there's no question that we don't believe in just cultivating emotions, and that the perfected person is the one who simply has a certain type of an emotional disposition. But the emotional disposition should be one that's most in line with the truth of human existence. That's a human being. That is to say that in order to achieve perfection, to obtain truth and to live in accordance with truth, a person has to work on their emotions as well. If the emotional disposition of a person is very arrogant, is very haughty, is very egotistical, so no matter how much that person studies, they really can't get too much out of their knowledge because their whole essence is going to be contrary to that knowledge. The real idea of knowledge in Yahadus is that it should form a person's values. And it should permeate the person's soul, and the person should be drawn after the good that the mind works out for him, that the mind discovers. So there's always that conflict between the emotional makeup of a person and the truth of his existence, the reality factor. Therefore, a person has to engage on working on his emotions. Now, when you work on your emotions, you want to eliminate the negative emotions, and you want to cultivate the positive emotion. There is such a thing as a positive emotion. It would seem then that the of all the various emotions, the one that's most suited to a person's perfection is compassion. Compassion takes in it's a huge sphere. Because a person is compassionate, then they're not egotistical. And there's a certain humbleness, there's a certain humility, there's a certain awe of the creator and the creation. And again, it just can't be a blind emotion of compassion. That too can be evil. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about cultivating the appropriate emotional disposition which would be most in line with the life of truth. And that seems to be the Ramban's interpretation of the mitzvah of Kan Zibor. If that is the case, then perhaps this is the idea with regard to Eiver Min HaChai, that it really, essentially, is a form of cruelty. Once God gave Adam permission to partake of meat, so then it becomes an opportunity for the person to act in a very aggressive kind of a fashion, to blunt the emotion of compassion. That's a conflict right there. Because these are living beings with pain. An animal also has the state of, I'm not going to use happiness and unhappiness like a person does, but the same is true. I mean, it's Tzar Bali Chaim to inflict any kind of suffering or pain on an animal is a prohibition. They suffer pain, and this renders the person, it's a corrupting of the person. It's not just a matter that the animal will suffer pain, but it corrupts you, because you're removing the element of compassion from your soul. And a perfected individual has to be a compassionate person. The person who's an achzar, who's cruel, is an evil person. So it could be that that's a basic, that's a fundamental of human perfection. That the person has to have a certain type of a emotional disposition which is in line with perfection. And someone who's an achzar is a Russian, is a wicked person. So an achzar is a cruel individual who does not have any type of a sensitivity to the pain of other beings, not just people, but other beings, animals. So it could be that that is the underlying reason. And it's expressed in this way, that when a person wants to partake of meat, so it creates this desire. The desire to take the animal, to gratify its own, to use the animal to gratify its own hunger, its own needs. And this creates a certain lack of consideration, lack of sensitivity. So the Torah demands that you can't subject the animal to torture to satisfy your desires. Now I'm contending that it would break down, it would destroy the element of compassion within you and would have the effect of making you into an achzar. This being the case then, we could deduce certain things from this. We could deduce that hunting, for example. The whole category of cruelty to animals would be included in this heading. That is not to say that we're not permitted to use animals for... I'm not taking the position of those who say that you can't kill animals for the fur or other purposes. No, it's all been given over into the... to the hands of Adam, that the human beings are permitted to have dominion over the animals and to use them for human purposes, whether it be for food, whether it be for other purposes as well. However, the manner in which you treat them has to, it's not a contradiction. I don't maintain that slaughtering an animal for human food is cruelty. That's not cruelty. That's those, the animal rights activists who maintain that principle, have this false notion of what compassion is and what cruelty is. You can see the way they behave. Total disrespect for the rights of humans. Mm-hmm. That is not the case, because it all is determined by the mind. If something was created, if God created the animals, God placed them here, and if God gave us permission to partake for human sustenance, so then doing so is not cruelty. But it all depends upon the manner in which you go about it. If you say that that's it, now that I have a right to use it, I can go about it in any way that I want, and there's no need to restrain myself, so then it can become cruel. You have to recognize the reality. That the reality is that there are beings that are going to be suffering depending on how you relate to them, so that you have to take into consideration. If you respect that, and you treat them in the appropriate way, with a humane type of death, so then you will not become a cruel person. But if you give into that emotion, that is to say that that's it, it's, I can do whatever I want, and there's no need to recognize that there's an element of causing pain, then it's going to strengthen within you the aggressive instinct and the cruel instinct. There's an instinct of sadism, which is very, very significant. It's a very powerful force. You see, in terms of people, how they relate to others, the cruelties that they inflict on others. At all points in history, and certainly in this generation, when evil governments killed millions and millions of innocent people, that's a sadistic. See, the sadistic emotion is extremely powerful, and that's the destruction of Adam. So in my opinion, this could very well be to place a certain check on the sadistic element, two things, a check on the sadistic element and a cultivation of the compassionate element, which is a universal phenomenon for the Bnei Noach as well as for Jews. But I'm saying that the philosophical idea behind it is not to inflict pain, unnecessary pain on an animal, or to behave in a cruel fashion towards an animal. It would carry over then to other forms of cruelty. Hunting for sport. In which case, there you see. Well, what's the emotion that's being gratified? There's the emotion of being a conqueror. That's very much a sadistic type of phenomenon. No question about it. Hunting for a positive purpose is one thing. But hunting for sport is cruelty. And the enjoyment, seems to me, if there's no use for the animal, is simply to be sadistic, to conquer the animal, which is a complete distortion of the purpose. God did not put animals in the world for you to have the sense of conquest.
There's no practical gain.
And to recap the line of argument, this would apply even to fishing. One's permitted to fish if one wants to eat the fish, but to do so just for sport, it seems to me, even though they throw the fish back, but there is an element of pain that's being inflicted on the fish. And therefore, to blunt yourself towards the natural reaction of activity towards the pain of another living being, to uproot that element from your soul is not negative. You're training yourself to be sadistic. And to remove compassion from yourself, which you see the Torah to the contrary. It said that you shall not take the mother together with its chicks. There are certain emotions that a person should cultivate, and it's not a good thing if these emotions become blunted. Now there is a natural reaction of compassion when you see certain types of people in distress. But it's possible for people to get over that. For example, if you work in emergency rooms or whatever, or people that are constantly working in high-stress situations where you're dealing with severely injured people. So there is a bit of a conflict because a person can't work unless they get over that emotion. If they're going to have the same reaction all the time to a human tragedy, they're not going to be able to function. So they have to harden themselves. And then they're able to function effectively. However, for people to harden themselves and therefore to lose a certain emotional sensitivity is not necessarily a beneficial thing. So I'm not talking about doctors and all of that. I mean, that's an issue that they have to work out. But I'm just trying to show you that a person can, through constant exposure, get over certain types of emotions, which it may be better for them to have that emotion. I'll give you other examples. People have a certain natural sense of shame. Without having to go into specifics, there are certain things you're not going to do publicly. But then there are people that make a point of trying to break down these emotions, because they think that they're inhibitions and they're not beneficial. They want to be free souls. So therefore, a person can do many things. A person can urinate in public. And at first they're going to feel shame, but if they do it a number of times, they're going to lose that sense of shame, and they can go ahead and do other things. They can go nude in public and other types of things, and do other kinds of activities, which I don't have to spell out specifically. Now, as a result of this, a person can put themselves on a program, a training program, and after 6 months, they have no sense of shame whatsoever. Okay, fine. Is that good for them? In terms of the entire, nature of their spiritual life, is that really good? I think it's seriously questionable, because having these emotions keeps a person in check, a certain type of a modesty, a certain type of a resistance to sinning, and so on and so forth. Let's face it, we're not all operating in terms of perfect truth all the time. You have certain emotions that keep you in check, and if you're going to remove all those emotions from a person, or to remove all those emotions from a society, then there'd be dire consequences. So that's the general approach that I'm using over here. You see what I'm saying? And I want to emphasize that the way a person is structured, there are certain very powerful emotions within us. And virtually all of them are subject to being broken down in terms of you can train yourself. You can get over the power of the individual. You see, people get over fears. They get over inhibitions. So that could be a good thing. I mean, which fears you choose to work on to get over, you have to use your intelligence on that. If there's it's an irrational fear, or it's a fear which is holding you back from doing something positive, so it's a good idea to work on it. But I'm just trying to show you that there are many good emotions, so to speak, that are necessary that a person can break down in the same way. And once you uproot those emotions from your soul, so then you're less of you're functioning less like a true human being. It's not a healthy thing for you. I guess you could all see that in the case of shame.